Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Double X is brought to you by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just 6 simple questions at clubw.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/XX. And by Squarespace, start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code XX at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And by bowlandbranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Go to bowlandbranch.com, that's bowlandbranch.com, and use the promo code XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, December 10th, the Naked Amy Schumer edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah. Hey, we're not in the same studio today, but Noreen and I are watching you on the cover of The New Yorker.
Oh, you are?
Totally.
What am I doing on the cover of The New Yorker?
You're looking in the mirror and talking.
I have an ambivalent relationship with that cover of The New Yorker because Chris Ware, who I absolutely adore, who's the cartoonist, said, you know, I'm not going to meet you. It's not going to look anything like you. My daughter, for example, has blonde hair, and I never have worn that shade of lipstick nor a blue flowered shirt in my whole life. But he, you know, so I look at it. I saw a bunch of people reading it on the Metro. And I thought, is that me? Is that not me? Do I feel like a little frisson of thrill, or do I not identify with it at all? I'm confused. My voice is obviously my voice in the animation. That is me. But the picture confuses me when I look at it.
The picture, I didn't recognize it. I got my New Yorker and I didn't realize that you were involved with it. It doesn't look anything like you. But wait, should we explain what the project was quickly?
Yeah. So this project came about, started with a Slate podcast. I told a little story about a parenting fail on Mom and Dad Are Fighting, which somebody at This American Life heard and asked if I could retell the story to This American Life because it fit in with one of their themes. They didn't end up using it, but Ira Glass, who is the host of This American Life, was at that moment trying to do a collaboration with Chris Ware, who's a cartoonist for The New Yorker. They wanted to do an animated New Yorker cover. So it's like, that's how it happened. Like, my story just landed in the lap of this collaboration that really had nothing to do with me. I didn't put it together. I just said, sure, you can use my story. And there it was.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who are we speaking with? It's Noreen Malone.
Oh, hi.
I totally interrupted.
Hi.
Yeah, who's that? Noreen Malone. Where do you work again?
New York Magazine.
Oh, congratulations.
Our covers are not animated, but you should check them out anyway.
Yeah, you just got a big shout out from Columbia Journalism Review, one of many that you've gotten for that New York Magazine cover. So congratulations.
Thanks.
Okay, let's move on to our topics. Our first topic is Tashfeen Malik, the female half of the San Bernardino couple. She had a baby at home when she did the shooting. That's very unusual. Who is she and where did she come from? Second, false narratives of anorexia. We talked to Katie Waldman, who's the author of a beautiful essay in Slate this week. And finally, the Pirelli calendar. No one is naked. Yay, we're supposed to be very happy about that. We will discuss. Okay, Tashfeen Malik. The media and probably the FBI are having a hard time pinning her down because a female shooter who is still nursing a baby is not a type that people can make sense of. So what do we know about her? She's from Pakistan. Yes?
Yes.
She grew up mostly in Saudi Arabia. She went to a madrasa after studying pharmacy, and a madrasa is a religious school in Pakistan, which is oddly always described as being for posh, ultra-conservative women.
Yeah, that was a very strange little trope in some of the coverage. I guess it's the Al-Huda Institute, which is run by a woman and seems to, as at least according to the various news reports, cater to rich women.
So this is like the DAR of
madrasas.
Yeah. So her people just don't know that much about her. Like, her family history is sort of vaguely emerging. Let's just start with her family history, and then I really want to talk about how the press has been covering her. But the family history, vaguely, her father seems to have had some rift with his own family. So you get the sense that there was some, you know, like family tension in her household. And she moved from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia.
You're right, which is kind of a, you know, standard move. There are a lot. Saudi Arabia has a huge immigrant population. The people who do the work tend to come from other countries. And it's funny because as I was reading the coverage, a lot of it struck me as very much like the sort of pieces that Josh Keating writes about, you know, if it happened here, how would we cover it? Yes, Saudi Arabia is an incredibly conservative place. And surely being there and spending some formative years there made her more conservative. But, you know, my coming to America made me more conservative. We all are affected by where we live. That's not necessarily in itself sinister. And then when she went back to Saudi Arabia to go to school, she apparently got a scholarship that's available to expats, to Pakistani expats. She was a little different because she was, generally speaking, practicing a more conservative Islam than her compatriots. But again, that doesn't seem all that strange. Going to a madrasa, if you are an observant Muslim, is not necessarily sinister. Naturally, when something as obscene as this shooting happens, you go looking at the history and try and find things. But I'm not sure, from what I've seen, that there would have been any reason to, you know, have heightened suspicions. We don't have heightened suspicions because of where people come from, or indeed how they dress. So she did wear, not only wear hijab, but she also wore the niqab, the covering of the face.
But there's no evidence that, according to everything we've read so far, the couple self-radicalized, which means via the internet, you know, sort of probably the corners of the ISIS internet, not in Saudi Arabia. You know, she grew up, her family was Sufi, and then she began practicing Wahhabism when she was in Saudi. But, you know, that, like you said, that is different than being radicalized.
And there's elements of her biography which are, for that context, I wouldn't say progressive, but a little bit progressive. She chose to study pharmacy. She chose to come to the U.S. and marry an American. She could have gone in a lot of different directions. She could have married an ISIS fighter, or she could have married someone in Saudi Arabia. So it's a little confusing to make total sense of her early biography.
Right. And you know, there are, again, items in her biography that can be, you know, you can choose to, you know, sort of swirl out of control about, that seem really strange to me as somebody who looks terrible in photos but likes to have my picture taken. You know, the fact that after she graduated from college in Pakistan, she wanted to have all of the pictures that had been taken of her during her student years destroyed or removed from databases because she didn't like photos. Her belief was that, you know, she had a dislike of photos.
Well, she didn't want to be photographed
without hijab. Yeah, and without the niqab.
Yeah, but that's sign. If you're like an investigator and you're looking for a path to radicalization and when did it start and who influenced her and was it this teacher or this madrasa, or, you know, if you're just looking for roots, that probably, to me, seems like a legitimate one. Like, when did she start to separate herself from what other people were doing? When she lived in this dorm, when she was studying pharmacy, she apparently explicitly requested that she be transferred somewhere else because the other people in the dorm were not she didn't like how they were, which signals to me. I actually had a friend who lived in a dorm in Jordan, and she said behind closed doors, the women are just like in little neon shorts. Like, it's total sexy girl time when the boys are not around. And so she probably was completely alienated by that.
Right.
It sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay, so then she comes to America, she marries this guy, and at this point, the media in the last week, the press reports have gone back and forth between she radicalized him or he radicalized her.
Right.
Yeah, and they can't decide. And I'm not sure which, like, I'm not sure that any of them has any basis in fact.
Right.
Like, she radicalized him is just what you were saying, June. She grew up in Saudi Arabia and seemed more conservative, and he seemed like one of those nice American guys, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know what's bothering me about this? It's like we have to learn the media lessons every single time. Like, how many men have we seen who have grown up in America and were somehow radicalized in New Jersey or upstate New York, even though they seem like dudes wearing sweatpants and listening to hip hop, you know?
Right. Well, and also, like, having assault rifles, that's a very American pursuit. I mean, maybe they were both, well, he's born in America, he's an American, but maybe they were Americanized. You know what I mean? Like, why are we so radicalized is a term we only use for people who aren't us. That seems very American to have a bunch of guns.
Well, I think people have just generally been fascinated by the role of women in ISIS, myself included.
Yep.
Because I think I wrote down a stat that 14% of the people who have been arrested for trying to join ISIS in the West or in America, in the United States alone, have been women. I think, you know, you read all the time about women in Western Europe who are moving to join the cause. And so that's one part of it, is that it's this terrorist movement where women have a huge role, like largely as helpmates. But, you know, in the Paris attack, that there was a young woman who was involved. In the Charlie Hebdo attack, there was a young woman who was involved, not in the actual attack themselves, but like in the sort of planning and sort of taking care of where they lived. And so that's one strain of it. And then you have also the news reports that, you know, ISIS is built on like an eschatology of rape and that they hold sex slaves in their territory. And so it's just like the role of women in ISIS, I think, is just a thing that puts, like, just freezes us in stone. And we're like, what do we do, you know?
You know, but there are two different kinds of ISIS women, because I'm deep in here, too. I read all the stories about ISIS women. One is the kind that actually goes to marry an ISIS fighter. And there, your life is very particular, and you know what it's like, and you're entirely, either you're one from one of the surrounding countries, and you're in, you know, you're a sex slave, or you go there and you're just a wife living with a niqab, raising babies. ISIS, unlike, say, Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, does not want women to fight. It doesn't let women fight. It's totally explicit about that, which isn't true of Al-Qaeda. But the ones who stay in the U.S. or who stay in France, like this woman, that's a different instinct. You know, she is one of the people who made a choice to stay here and be herself a shooter, participate. And I feel that's a meaningful distinction.
I mean, there are so many ways that, as all the coverage has mentioned, that this couple differ from typical shooters, typical, you know, the people that we define as terrorists. Most mass shooters are white. Most are single. Most have really attenuated ties to community and family.
I find the comparison that people are making to mass shooters a little bit incorrect. You know, there is this whole thing where, you know, men direct violence outward, women tend to direct it inward, like that she doesn't fit the profile of a mass shooter. But to me, this is to them, it was holy war. It wasn't, you know, a mass shooting. It wasn't an expression of anger. It's, you know, a terrorist action that is part of a larger scope of things, right? Which I think a lot of mass shooters don't see themselves as part of a larger scope of things.
Right.
So to me, the thing that people are saying, well, women don't shoot in this way, I just think it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's not quite a correct comparison to make.
I also think, even though statistically it's true, it's more men, more disaffected men, there's just a lot of lazy female stereotypes that mm-hmm. get trotted mm-hmm. out in these moments. Mm-hmm. Always, whenever there's a shooter, it used to happen with suicide bombers, people would attribute gendered kind of motivations to the woman. And I actually read a great study, which I wrote about in my book, which is this was a graduate student who systematically looked at the media reports where they would say, oh, this woman was mentally ill, or she was, you know, she was doing her husband's bidding. And it turned out to be not true. Mm-hmm. Women blow stuff up for the same reason that men do, which is that they're dedicated to the cause. You know, they're total zealots. They've bought into this thing. And the other thing about women is that they're incredibly effective at it because they can hide a lot of bombs and guns under their under what they're wearing. And they also people don't suspect them as much. You know, like in the Slate story, you know, it had that whole thing that you said, Noreen, you know, men are likely to, you know, to take their sense of failure or shame outwards. And this is a quote from a director of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at University of Nebraska. It says, whereas women are more likely to develop negative attributions of blame that are internal in nature. You know, I failed. It's like taking these kind of lazy business schooly stereotypes about women and applying them to a completely unusual situation. It happens all the time. It drives me crazy.
Well, there's another thing, too. I think that because she wore hijab and because she wore niqab, and apparently because she chose not to really socialize with men or really, it seemed, speak with hardly anybody. And it's not clear to me if she spoke English. Some of the reports said not, but they weren't necessarily reliable, I thought. So this was a person who was very isolated from the people around her. So I think you or David many years ago, Hannah, wrote a great piece about after something outrageous happens, people go to the neighbors and they said, "Oh, what kind of person was he or she?" And they'll say, "Oh, you know, she was a nice quiet. It was a nice quiet couple, or he was a you know a nice neighbor." In this case, people don't know anything at all about her, and
right.
Even at the mosque or mosques plural where her husband worshipped, she never went inside. She sat outside. So, like, there is no context for her, and she seems to be very mysterious to people. Which, again, you know, you can spin in many ways, and if there's a way that you can make that really alien, then in this case people have. And you know, I understand that because it's very, very puzzling. So I understand it in a way, but there is a lot of sort of lazy and sexist stereotyping going
on. Yeah, like why can't we, this is a week when we let women into combat. So I'm not suggesting there's any connection between these two trends, but it's like the mind can't grasp the idea of women who want to fight, like really be violent and fight even for a cause, which she seems to have been. And so the baby comes up in her profiles and not his profiles. Now, what do you guys think about that? Like, we instinctively think that's okay. Like, we understand that about the female nature. It's really weird to think of a woman who is nursing a baby. Is it just as weird to think of a father who has a six-month-old as doing the same thing?
It's weird to think of both, but I will admit, I know it sounds retrograde, but I found that detail more shocking than anything, that she had a new baby. That and I, you know, I think that there is more of a biological connection between a nursing mother. Although, was she nursing? Because it said there were formula bottles there. Anyway,
probably both. I mean,
yeah.
That was the details. It's like the FBI walked into the house and they both see baby swings and mm-hmm. formula and nursing stuff and a cache of weapons.
Yeah, I just on a basic level found it more shocking that, you know, a mother would do it than a father. And that, I'm sure, makes me sexist, but that was and kind of is my reaction. And yeah, I can't really get around that.
But maybe that's legit. That's what I'm saying. I'm pushing. Maybe there just is something just fundamentally at a visceral level difficult to grasp.
Well, and then, but then some of the coverage was like, oh, she had postpartum depression and then, or like postpartum psychosis, and that pushed her to do it, which also seems like, okay, like calm down, like let's not just ascribe everything in the book to her. But I did have the thought, thinking about, you know, self-radicalization, thinking about the corners of the internet where ISIS sort of recruits and rallies people, that if you've ever watched a new mother on like a parenting forum or like mommy blogs, they do sort of disappear into the world of the internet because you're just sitting at home alone with the baby. And like, you know, the world of the internet is so much more enticing in some ways, or at least a distraction from the baby.
Ooh, that's a good theory.
Yeah.
That's an excellent theory.
You know, like she's just sitting at home. She doesn't know anyone in America. And, you know, ISIS is all over the news. You log on and, you know, that maybe that happens.
Excellent theory, because she's in America, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she doesn't really talk to anyone. She doesn't speak English and her husband's away at work. That's a really good theory, because when you read those profiles of the ISIS women, that's who they are. They have, you know, they're usually women who are isolated for one reason or another. They're shy or they don't have friends, but they have some reason to spend a lot of time on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, you just solved this mystery. Thank
mommy,
you.
Through mommy blogs or ISIS.
Mommy blogs cause mass shooting. That's your headline.
Oh, God.
Good job. Okay, we solved the problem. Let's move on to our next topic. But before we do that, let's thank our first sponsor.
The XX GabFest is sponsored by Club W. 9,000 years. That's how long humans have been making wine. That's also how long they've been confused about which wine to drink. I don't know if I've been confused for 9,000 years personally, but at least a decade now. I basically just go in and I'm like, give me your most middling bottle of $12 wine, red or white, and I sometimes pink, and then I walk out and give it to my host or hostess at a dinner party and call it a day. But as a person who basically wine is my preferred alcohol, it's embarrassing how little I know about it until I began nosing around on clubw.com. So if you go to clubw.com, you just answer six simple questions and then it creates a palate profile just for you. You know, do you like dry wine? Do you like sweet wine? Do you whatever it is? Then they will send the wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste at a third of what you'd pay at the store. So for my $12 bottle of wine, maybe that's a $4 bottle. It doesn't work out quite that way, but you know, I think you're getting nicer wine than that. So they even have a no risk, 100% guarantee that you'll love what they send you. And so right now, Club W is offering XX GabFest listeners 50% off your first order when you go to clubw.com/XX. It's a pretty good deal. So stop wasting time and money messing around at the wine store and just start drinking wine you know you're going to love. So just one more time, clubw.com/XX for 50% off your first order.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic. We're going to talk to Katie Waldman, the author of a beautiful essay in Slate called There Once Was a Girl, Against the False Narratives of Anorexia. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So can we start by your telling the story of your family in Dublin and what happened? Because I feel like that's a good setup to tell us about the dynamics and the issues. A lot of it arose in that moment.
Sure. I mean, I think this was an instance that encapsulated a lot of the dynamics that have been going on in my family for a while. Basically, we went to Dublin and we saw a lot of sights. It was lovely. And then we had a dinner party that we had to go to because we were there for my dad's tennis event. And my sister really wanted to take a run. So we all we left the museum early and we went back. But the treadmill, as she was working out in the gym, was logging kilometers instead of miles or something. And she didn't want to convert it. So she freaked out and started running outside. And it basically took an hour and a half. And we ended up being an hour and a half late to the dinner party that was thrown in my dad's honor because of my sister's rigidity around exercise. I should also say that I was at that point was more recovering. I am still recovering. You never are recovered from an eating disorder, but I was more in the like yellow zone of recovery than I am now, as opposed to the green zone. And I also was working out in the gym, but I was ellipticaling. Anyway, I just want to put that in to be fair.
And the what we took from that story is that you and your family had different reactions to that incident, to that
yes.
whole evening is when you felt alienated. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I guess, you know, we came back from the dinner party and my parents said, you know, we're really proud of you. Girls, you were charming tonight at the party. And I flipped out because, you know, we had been really late and my sister hadn't eaten anything at the party, which I felt was very rude. And probably I was just being triggered by it also. Anyway, so I told my parents, like, I don't think that's an appropriate response, basically. And then they thought that I was being crazy and sick and competitive. And they're not completely wrong, but it was very painful to me to be worried about my sister and like to find something unacceptable and something that needed to be addressed. And they were just kind of papering over it. So,
I mean, I got the feeling from reading that story and the whole essay which was just unbelievably beautifully written. And it felt like something that had been rolling around in your head for a really long time, just because you were able to see all sides of it. I mean, I bet if you had written the essay just when you got back from Dublin, it would have been more reactive. Mm-hmm. And now that some months have passed, it just felt like something you'd been working through forever.
Yeah, that is true. And a funny story, I actually did write that section right when I got back from Dublin, and then went through a lot of editing on it. But that piece of writing, that sort of memoiristic part, predates the Fresca project. Like, I was writing all this stuff down because I actually, when I got back from Ireland, my parents and I went through a period of estrangement. We didn't talk for almost a year, and that was really hard. So I was writing about that. And then when I got approached for the Fresca project, because most Slate staffers are supposed to do that, I said, oh my gosh, I can't not write about this. I'll just write about this.
I'm so glad you did, Katie, because it is an amazing piece. And I have to say that that section of it was the part that felt most immediate to me, that felt most, you know, I got really wrapped up in it too. I was like, maybe because I know you and like you so much, that I was like, come on, man, Katie's right. Get behind Katie here. But then, you know, you had this line there that, you know, you talked about the complicated fear and sadness I felt for E was recast as vindictiveness. So that's also really brilliant. That it's wonderful to see that you can be aware of what's going on in a specific moment, but then also, you know, see it from a different perspective. It just kind of opened something up to me that I hadn't understood before.
Do you feel like you use this essay to explain something to yourself about anorexia or understand something? Because if your experience of anorexia is getting trapped in a false narrative, quite literally, you look at your body and you're seeing something that isn't true and isn't there for various reasons, which you explain in the story. You know, there are cultural reasons, biological reasons. So I thought, well, maybe this essay is an attempt to rewrite the narrative or break into that false narrative that you feel like you're imprisoned in.
Totally. That was absolutely what it was. And I had felt sort of the damage being done by the various narratives floating around in my family. Now I can understand things like, you know, their protectiveness of their daughters is really lovely, and I'm really lucky to have that when it is turned on me as opposed to my sister. And anyway, I think it was both an effort to find the correct narrative to apply to my situation and an admission that there can never just be one, that there are all kinds of narratives that have grains of truth in them, and they come from me and they come from my parents. And basically, life is sorting through the stories that we're constantly telling ourselves and drawing from each one what we can. And I think, yeah, recovery for me was a lot about banishing the ones that weren't working, the narratives that weren't working.
I mean, I actually think that's why the essay was brilliant and the writing was so good, is because it was constantly considering alternate narratives as you were writing it. You were able, in probably a way you weren't right after that Dublin trip, to consider in a sincere emotional way your parents' perspective or your sister's perspective and take it in, which is probably part of healing and also part of beautiful writing.
And it wasn't just your own personal narratives that you wrote about in this, right? You have sort of the narratives of women who've suffered from anorexia through history, although they haven't been labeled as such. And then what I also thought was interesting near the end of your piece is you had sort of the evolving scientific narrative around anorexia. You know, it went from people saying it was women afraid of getting pregnant to, you know, your unbearable mother. And that part was interesting to me, what you did with that. And you said, you know, you sort of walked us through the science, but it's also sort of what you tell yourself.
Can you talk about some of the false narratives of anorexia and how they impacted you?
Sure. So I actually mind melded with a young adult author when I was 10, 11, 12 named Francesca Leah Block, who it turns out was anorexic and wrote an essay later in an anthology that I cite in the piece called Going Hungry. And her fiction was this very sort of delicate, beautiful, lyrical writing about waif-like figures and sort of glamorous women. And I thought that was so cool. And I wanted to burn vanilla scented candles and like lather my skin in peach. Like she'd have these huge lists of like various ripe fruits and spices and just like sensual things. And I thought like this was so amazing. And basically, I went back and read that stuff after reading her Going Hungry essay and realized it's basically thinspo. Like, it's kind of gross and irresponsible, and I hope she's not offended by if she ever encounters my essay, but it was a real...
That has to be a moment like you turn on Judy Blume. You know, you're a bad lady, Judy. Oh, boy.
And then, of course, it didn't help.
Can you tell people what thinspo is? Does everybody know what thinspo is? I'm not sure everybody knows what thinspo is.
It's just an abbreviation for thinspiration. So there are media, cultural things, whether it's pictures or poems or and other pieces of writing that glorify thinness and mm-hmm. are inspirational to anorexic people.
I was very interested to read how important family can be in influencing anorexia. I don't know if that's actually an accurate representation. I have to tell a story from my life, which is my aunt is the only working class person I know who's ever had anorexia. And, you know, she left school when she was 15. She doesn't self-narrate. She wasn't influenced by literature. But in my family, I was always called Little June and she was called Big June.
Oh, gosh.
And she was not big, but I've always felt that maybe that was what happened. And of course, I realize that's like totally narcissistic and putting myself at the center of the universe. But like, that's crazy. On the other hand, I kind of think that, you know, it was her mother who was saying that, her family. I was just a little girl. It wasn't me. But first of all, is that crazy? And B, how central are family dynamics in among the many false narratives? How it does seem like the family, you know, is really standing over all this, really big in the center of it.
Yeah, gosh, that's so interesting. I mean, there was a time when 100% of eating disorders was chalked up to damaging family dynamics. And now that there are biological explanations, that has been challenged. On the other hand, I strongly feel that anorexia is a disease that has to do with identity. And family, obviously, is your first sort of mirror. And depending on how close you are as you get older, they reflect yourself back to you and they are a source of approval or disapproval. And for me, I think I spent a lot of time establishing my identity in opposition or in comparison to my twin sister and seeing myself not only through my eyes, but through my parents' eyes and her eyes and the eyes of everyone who perceived the Waldman twins as a unit as opposed to two separate individuals. And so I do think family, at least for me, was totally central.
You write a little bit about the advancement in scientific knowledge about anorexia. Can you just say what it is and how it changes the whole understanding of what anorexia is and how to cure it?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely takes the element of will a little bit out of it. One thing is that anorexia is basically hereditary. It's biological. I think twins have an 8 to 11 times higher chance of getting anorexia if the other twin.
You know, that's so interesting. Yeah. I read that and thought that's either because of the particular social cultural dynamic of twins, that close comparison, or is biological. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I think actually it's even higher for identical twins than fraternal. Uh-huh. But yeah, it is higher for fraternal twins than for regular siblings. So a little bit of both. And then the other thing is there's evidence that people who go on to develop anorexia have a particular personality profile, sort of inborn traits, perfectionism, risk aversion, just higher levels of anxiety. They may have less serotonin in their brains, which can mess with sort of hunger and satiety signals. There's evidence that the insula, which is a different part of the brain, doesn't work as well in anorexics, and that that part of the brain controls body image and also responding to rewards. So there's a lot of sort of fledgling science that's really suggestive, although it hasn't really concluded.
And does anything. This help you? Like, how does knowing about this science, does it change anything for you?
Well, it's a bit of absolution, I think, to some extent. Like, oh, this isn't my fault. This is a disease like diabetes. And that's great. But I also think it's a little too simplistic to take all of the psychological struggling out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Katie, it was an amazing essay. I encourage everyone to read it. It's called There Once Was a Girl, Against the False Narratives of Anorexia by Katie Waldman in this week's Slate. And it was great to have you.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Katie. Bye. It was so good.
Let's move on to our third topic, the Pirelli calendar. But before we do that, let's thank our next sponsor.
So when you work at a website, as I have for many years now, you get used to having these incredible tech people make it so that basically a 3-year-old child or a fairly domesticated cat could publish a really gorgeous looking website. Everything is done for you. It's a thing of beauty, and it gives you a pride that you really don't deserve. Well, imagine my relief when I realized that Squarespace, who is our second sponsor today, also makes it so easy to make professionally designed websites that look great, without having to pull your hair out, because regardless of skill level, and you do not need to know any coding, you can make a fabulous site with their intuitive and easy to use tools. And you can even get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial site today at squarespace.com. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code XX to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
Let's move on to our third topic, the Pirelli calendar. First, Playboy, now the Pirelli calendar. The arty softcore porn calendar has for the first time women in clothing, smart women in clothing, impressive women in clothing, even older women, God forbid, in clothing. What is going on? So just who wants to tell like the basic story of how this came about with Annie Leibovitz?
Feminism.
Feminism.
They're ruining it all. No. I actually don't know if I can tell the basic story. I thought
Annie Leibovitz is hired to shoot the 2015 calendar. And she just like does. That's how they work, right? They hire somebody and she's Annie Leibovitz. And so she decides to do something different.
But she has done the calendar before, actually. She did it. I saw photos that she did in the year 2000 where she sort of did a more traditional, if arty, take on the Pirelli nude. And so in all of the articles that I read about it, it was sort of like Pirelli making, you know, pushed by Annie Leibovitz in this direction, but sort of making the decision that like, okay, it's 2015. Women have a lot of buying power now.
I hate that. You know, I hate when they add all that like buying power crap to the end of every little tiny. I mean, come on.
No, like, but that's true. Really what, it's really? True. I think it's like acknowledging that women are tastemakers more than they ever have been, and that this manifests itself in ways both large and small. And I think this is actually a pretty small way, right? But
God, but that's so cynical. It's 2015. They couldn't have naked ladies on the cover and the office of the thing just because then they think like, oh, the women are going to buy Mercedes instead of our cars. And so we better stop having naked women in our calendar.
I don't think it's that, though. Look, this we should mention that the Pirelli calendar is not something that's sold. It's just given out to 20,000 VIPs.
And even worse, June.
No,
that's
I haven't finished. Yeah. And even, first of all, Pirelli, yes, let's stipulate, is getting excessive credit or even discussion points around this because it seems like they had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was basically Annie Leibovitz because essentially the photographer gets full control and Annie Leibovitz just called up a bunch of people who, you know, are just like famous women. She didn't call people, she called women. And so, yeah, A, that's why it's different. But B, I do think that when you present this calendar, and not only to the 20,000 very important people, but even at the reception in London, this big, huge international reception, it's just getting to be embarrassing to have this nudie thing because there are more and more women who are legitimately there as the invitees rather than as the plus ones. And so, yeah, it's ridiculous that in 2015 is, or I guess for the 2016 calendar, this is the year this is happening. But I do think it's incontrovertible that it's becoming more and more embarrassing that this is that the people who create it are essentially saying all the VIPs who get this are dudes. Like, that's just dumb.
Yeah, and I'm totally with you, except am I supposed to be grateful? Like, I get that it's embarrassing, but am I supposed to mark it as a great feminist
triumph? I don't think Pirelli cares about you.
Right. I think it
but the media marks it as a great feminist triumph of 2015.
I will represent the media here and say that I think it's a, if not great, a minor feminist triumph. I mean, so if you look at what the Pirelli calendar has represented, it's like the ideal of feminine beauty and like how that has changed over the years, right? It's just like the most glorious manifestation of what it means to be female is supposedly represented in these pages. And I think it's pretty rad that like this is what it is now, that it is all these women are beautiful and are photographed beautifully, but they, you know, they are elegant in different ways. And that is sort of what she's celebrating. And I know this is like basic self-confidence level feminism, but I like it. I'm into it.
You know, I just have one slight disagreement with you there, Noreen, which is that other than there's two pictures where there's sort of semi-nudity, which is to say that Amy Schumer and Serena Williams, right? Serena Williams.
Holy shit, that's Serena Williams picture.
No, I couldn't remember.
Whoa.
I couldn't remember if it was Venus.
What do you mean, holy shit?
Oh my God.
Strong lady. Strong
body.
Lady. Yeah.
It's her back. She looks like Adonis. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous what her back looks like. It's such a beautiful photograph.
Exactly. So those two where there's semi-nudity are, the Serena picture is amazing. It's gorgeous. The Amy Schumer picture is very funny and very sort of fraught with significance.
But isn't that one a joke? Like, I didn't get the memo.
Yeah, it's a joke. It's a total joke. But it's great. But then the others, as much as I love pretty much all the people in the photos, even though a couple of them I actually didn't know, they're kind of standard photos. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a standard Annie Leibovitz photo, so it's a pretty amazing photo. But they're kind of dull.
Right.
Like, you know, Fran Lebowitz, who I think is amazing, but, like, she's basically dressed in jeans and a blazer, which is how she dresses 365 days a year, and is just looking at the camera.
Yeah. It's famous people photographed kindly.
Yes.
Except for Serena and Amy, who, you know, got to do something. Those photos are more interesting. They show, like, sort of interesting parts of their body.
They make a statement.
Okay, so then is that, like, even I, as a woman, am I only interested in looking at other women if I get to dissect their bodies?
No,
like,
no.
You know?
No. No, but it's not about whether she made them beautiful or not. There's meaning-making happening usually in the Pirelli calendar, or at least creativity and artiness. You're not trying to do a Vogue photo shoot. You're trying to create something interesting, which usually ends up looking S&M-ish, frankly. It's usually like a red leather bustier, except you're, you know, with the boobs hanging out the top. It's like usually some interesting, arty, semi-pornographic picture. So maybe the point is, could she have brought out the essence of – she brought out the essence of Amy Schumer and Serena Williams. But I guess you're asking, did she bring out the essence of any of these women in any interesting way? Or did she just say, oh, I can make an older person look beautiful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. And the thing is, I think you are also being a little too kind or – cruelly kind to the typical Pirelli calendar, because it seems like, I don't know that it's all that arty. I think, like, you just show tits and everybody thinks it's arty. But, like, I don't know that they're all that
special. And yet you read the models. Like, if you look at the history of the Pirelli calendar, they're like, oh, my God, this is the best day of my life. I'm so relevant. This thing launched my career. Like, that kind of turns my stomach, that narrative, you know?
I mean, I guess you are you're among the elect. You're one of the 12.
Right. In defense of the boring pictures, you know, what these women are known for are their professional accomplishments. Many of them in creative fields, but definitely like sort of like power ladies. Mm-hmm. And part of what Amy Schumer and Serena are known for are their bodies and the way the public reads their bodies.
Right.
So I think, you know, there was just a little more to play with there.
Yeah.
And that, you know, to photograph, you know, Ava DuVernay, like, in the Amy Schumer pose would have been like,
right.
like not doing what you should have been doing there.
No, totally.
What about Tavi Gevinson, though? They didn't do much with her.
She looks beautiful. I mean, that is
she
a
always
fantastic
looks beautiful.
Shot. She looks great. But yeah, that doesn't tell me anything about her, except that she's a young woman who's quite composed, who's very composed.
Well, I am super surprised that this calendar didn't solve the mysteries of the universe and gender. I mean, what are they even putting it out for?
Touche, Noreen. Touche. Okay. You can go home and read your Playboy and feel happy
for the articles.
State of feminism. Exactly. Let's move on to our recommendations. But before we do that, let's thank our final sponsor.
So there's nothing I like better than sleeping. And the most important thing that you can do to ensure having a good day is getting a good night's sleep the night before. And one way to make that possible is to sleep on fantastic sheets. And one company has set out to improve the quality of American sheets. That's Boll & Branch. They have reinvented sheets and bedding with the sole purpose of making your nights more comfortable than ever. Their bedding is so soft, it will be the new standard of comfort you'll measure everything else by. Now, you can only get these products at one place, bollandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality sheets, not department store overhead. You're getting amazingly luxurious sheets for a couple of $100. Go online to Boll, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com. They'll even let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. And it gets even better. Go to bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything, plus free shipping. And all their products come beautifully packaged in their signature boxes. So go to bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order and use promo code XX. bollandbranch.com, promo code XX. Thank you, Boll & Branch.
Okay, recommendations. Noreen, what do you have?
I have two recommendations this week. The first, I watched the documentary Iris, which is streaming on Netflix now. It's a look by Alfred Mailses. How do you say his name? Mailses.
Sure.
Anyway, the guy who did Grey Gardens, who died this spring, I believe, at the age of 87, and it was a look at Iris Apfel, who is a legendary sort of crazy dresser. She has the most phenomenal innate sense of style, and she does not go for neutrals ever. And it's just really fun. I also wanted to recommend On Pandering, which is an essay in Tin House by the fiction writer Claire V. Watkins. And it is basically an argument, almost a manifesto towards the end, towards artists and writers not trying to like go towards the mainstream, which is presumed to be a man, a straight white man, and to instead represent their own experiences. And she does it very artfully and I think convincingly. It takes a little while to get going, but it sort of winds up and it has you really sort of agreeing with her by the end.
An interesting, super complex essay, which we almost discussed and maybe will one day.
Mm-hmm.
When we get like another bastard male artist. We'll just, you know, that will be our topic, the bastard male artist. Okay, I have two also. Noreen, you'll be so jealous. Now that I work at NPR, I actually get to go to these tiny desk concerts. And so whatever it is on those tiny desk videos, I get to see it live. It's really awesome. And Sharon Jones was there yesterday.
That's cool.
Yeah, she was awesome. Give the people what they want. She's amazing. This is an album that's had lots of stops and starts because she was going to release it. And then she got cancer. And boy, can that woman sing. She was really, really amazing. So watch the Tiny Desk concert on NPR and also listen to her songs, which were really great. My second recommendation is really weird. But whenever I do these recommendations, I think to myself, what gave me the most pleasure since our last show? And so Sharon Jones was the first. And the second, okay, don't make fun of me. You promise? You're not going to make fun of me?
I'm not promising anything.
Okay. Ugh. Damn it. Anyway, so this is like a DIY mom project, which gave me so much pleasure that I'm recommending it to people. I basically dug up in the attic for the kids' school photo pictures from beginning to now, like those like cheesy, hammy, like school pictures. And I just put them in a row on the refrigerator. And it's just so awesome to watch. I did it for every kid. And it's just like a beginning to end time reel.
Aww.
And they're all, yeah, it's really, it's just awesome. It's really cute. Maybe I'll post a picture of it somewhere of the whole compilation, but it was really, really satisfying. All right, that's as DIY as I get. June, your turn.
You hung things on the fridge.
I hung things on the fridge. No, but it's like,
are you gonna hire someone to do that?
No, but you know that that's not the trouble. The trouble is like you have to. Who the hell knows where like the one right. from first grade is and the one from sixth grade is? Like the thing, it's the object itself is not beautiful. It's like I'm telling people like take the time to go dig in there with those school pictures and then just like do it as this time reel, and it's really cute.
I file all my kids' stuff by date taken, and I've got 16 file folders of my imaginary children's photos.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. I don't have that. So it really took me a long time to like dig up all those grids. Anyway, go ahead, June.
Okay, so since everybody else is doing two, so will I. So the first one I want to mention, since Katie's essay mentions one of the Bronte sisters, which immediately made me think of the amazing monologue, I guess you would call it, the Haworth Parsonage tour guide by the amazing British humorist Victoria Wood. I don't know. There's really no way to describe it. So you just have to follow the link on our show page to experience this amazing thing. So yes, enjoy that.
Wait, but what the hell is
it? It's an imaginary spiel by a tour guide at the Haworth Parsonage Tour, which is to say the home of the Bronte sisters.
Oh,
and
all right.
And Branwell Bronte, of course. Sorry, I thought y'all would recognize what the Haworth Parsonage was.
Sorry.
We failed.
And then the other one, speaking of what gives us great pleasure. So I know I've talked about it before on this podcast and recommended it before, but Scott and Bailey, an amazing British show, a Northern Grimm, Cagney and Lacey. Season 4 just went on Hulu and it's fantastic. We inhaled it within days. There are 8 episodes, 8 hours of television, and it's just amazing. So enjoy it. Enjoy the north of England and all the grimness therein.
Excellent. Well, thank you both. Thanks especially to our producer, Anne Hepperman, to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our intern is Shiva Bayat. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. For more information about this show, slate.com/XX, or you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to recommend new topics or comment on the show. Our email is XXGabFest@slate.com, or you can subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Days of love.
Hi, I'm Mike Pesca, host of The Gist, a daily news podcast from Slate. Every weekday evening, I release a new episode featuring interviews and opinions about politics, culture, current events, and Donald Trump, who is like all three right now. But let me tell you what we aren't, so you could get to know me. The Gist, we're not talking about planking, ideas festivals, claymation, Dragon Ball Z, or scrapbooking, and we won't be wearing a knit cap and just a t-shirt. Who wants to listen to a podcast with that guy? It's not us. We're The Gist.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.